This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, I'm James Kamarasamy. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Monday, the 3rd of February. A day of deal-making in the White House after President Trump pauses the introduction of tariffs on Canadian and Mexican goods for 30 days. We hear about the impact the pre-announced trade war is already having and ask what is driving the US president's policy. We speak to the sister of Ruth Perry, the head teacher who took her own life, about the new Ofsted report cards. We have a report on medical evacuations from Gaza, hear about the plan to save Einstein's signature, and speak to the Nottingham landlady who scored an own goal as her local team won 7-0. With a US president who wrote a book called The Art of the Deal back in the White House, we are now seeing deals playing out in real time, deals with high stakes for the global economy. Today, Donald Trump pressed pause on his plan to introduce 25% tariffs on goods from one of America's neighbours, Mexico, hours before they were due to come into force. And in the last few minutes, he has confirmed he's agreed a similar 30-day freeze to tariffs with Canada, which was also threatened with those tariffs. Well, the Mexican delay followed a decision by the Mexican president, Claudia Sheinbaum, to send thousands of troops to the American border to help stem the flow of illegal drugs. Speaking from the Oval Office before the Canadian deal was announced, Mr. Trump said he had had a good conversation with his Mexican counterpart.
We're going to have a big negotiation with Mexico. I'll be involved too, and President Sheinbaum will be involved to see whether or not we can work something out on the tariffs. Yep. I also spoke with Prime Minister Trudeau of Canada, and we had a good talk. You know, we're not treated well by Canada, and we have to be treated well. I think we're going to have another good conversation today. We don't need them to make our cars. We don't need them to give us lumber. We don't need them for agricultural products because we have all the agriculture we need.
Well, let's speak to our North America editor, Sarah Smith. The news moves fast these days, Sarah. So just talk us through today, what was meant to be the eve of tariff day or tariffs coming into effect, and now we have neither of them.
Yes, things move quickly at this White House. That much is clear. It was over the weekend Donald Trump finally signed the order saying that these tariffs should begin, 25% on goods coming into the US from both Mexico and Canada. And then, as you mentioned, he spoke to the Mexican president and announced a 30-day pause in the tariffs. He sent two phone calls with Prime Minister Justin Trudeau today. The first this morning didn't appear to be terribly productive because the tariffs were still going to come into place. And then just a couple of hours ago, he spoke to him a second time, and they seem to have agreed enough to at least mean that there will be a pause in these tariffs coming in. Both have promised to beef up border security. The Mexican president said that she would send 10,000 soldiers to the Mexican border to try and stop both illegal immigrants and drugs, including fentanyl, crossing the border into America. The Canadians have agreed something similar, saying they'll spend over $1 billion on more security, and talking also about appointing a fentanyl czar to look at how to try and combat the scourge of drugs. But it's a tiny, tiny fraction of the fentanyl and of the illegal immigrants that enter the US that come across the Canadian border. So they were feeling a little hard done by that they were being threatened with the same penalties as Mexico. But that's got a lot more to do with the balance of trade between Canada and America. Basically, Canada exports a lot of goods into America where they are bought. America exports fewer into Canada. And that really seems to have got under Donald Trump's skin. He mentions it all the time. So he's going to look to negotiate a better deal where there are fewer restrictions on American imports being sold in Canada if Justin Trudeau wants to avoid these tariffs completely.
Will Donald Trump be looking at this and seeing that he's managed to get both these countries to blink pretty quickly?
Yeah, and he has. And this is not the first time either. You remember there was a row over deportation flights where he got the Colombian government to blink very quickly as well. This threat of tariffs was a very aggressive stance. 25% is a very, very high rate of tariffs, and it potentially had global consequences. It could have started a trade war as other countries put in place retaliatory tariffs. That's what Canada was threatening to do, saying if you put 25% tariffs on our goods, we'll do the same to yours. And it also had the potential of putting up prices of goods in America, the very thing Donald Trump promised to do the opposite of. He promised to reduce prices here. But of course, if you add tariffs to imported goods, the chances are the price of them is going to go up. So, you know, a lot of people suspected that this was an opening negotiating position rather than Donald Trump wanting to apply these tariffs. And if that was the case, it seems to have been an extremely effective one, because for now he is claiming victory from the Oval Office and saying that before he'd even introduced them, he's been able to get these nations to do what he wanted to as a result of, well, essentially bullying them via this economic weapon.
Sarah, many thanks. Our North America editor, Sarah Smith. Well, one sector in the United States that was very concerned about tariffs is the car industry and the companies that supply it. We can speak now to Bill Hanvey, who's president and CEO of the Auto Care Association. It's a trade association which represents manufacturers, distributors and sellers of vehicle parts. Good evening, Bill.
Good evening, Jamie. How are you?
Very well, thanks. Are you relieved by the deals that have been done this evening?
We are relieved. However, we've been doing our due diligence since the election was announced, and you know, we realized the winner. You know, President Trump has been running on this issue for the whole campaign, so it's something that we are certainly keeping our eye on as it develops. And as Sarah said, it's a very fluid situation.
And it's a pause. It's a 30-day pause so far. Just to be clear, Mexico and Canada, how important are they for you? How many parts do you get from those two countries?
Both of those countries are extremely valuable trading partners to the U.S. auto industry. And you know, we are a global industry. So, for example, you know, the imports that Mexico sends to the United States, you know, we import about $64 billion worth of automotive parts from Mexico. We import about $16 billion worth of automotive parts from Canada. But what we really don't talk about is the fact that many of those parts cross the border two or three times, depending upon whether that part is being used in OE production, it's being sent to Mexico to be finished, and then sent back to the U.S. for eventual usage on an original equipment automobile. So the implications are quite serious.
Yeah. I mean, so it's, what, $80 billion combined, you're saying. And on each crossing of the border, there would be tariffs to pay. And presumably, Canada would have slapped similar tariffs on, so you'd be paying both ways.
That's correct. And, you know, that's another thing that we're very concerned about is the retaliatory tariffs that those particular regions may impose on the U.S. as well. So, in effect, the U.S. consumer might see that the effects of those tariffs exponentially, both on the import and on the export side.
Well, you talked about due diligence. Does that mean you are now thinking about using solely or largely American parts?
Well, I think the manufacturers in the U.S. and the distributors in the U.S. Are looking for various means to support the industry. So would that be in Canada, Mexico, China, Vietnam, India? As I mentioned earlier, it is a global industry. So yes, the U.S. distributors are looking for other regions to produce these parts.
Yeah, I mean, you can't tear this apart just like that. There is a very complicated series of supply chains in place.
That's correct. And, you know, what people may not understand, if you own an older vehicle, say, for instance, that's over 15, 20 years old, that vehicle is no longer being produced. And the parts for that vehicle are no longer being produced domestically. So we have to look for alternative sources for those parts so people can upkeep their vehicle and perform maintenance on their vehicle and keep that vehicle in usage for a longer period of time.
Bill Hanvey, President and CEO of the Auto Care Association. Thanks very much. Well, let's turn to Canada now. We can speak to Perrin Beattie, a former Canadian foreign minister who was CEO of the Canadian Chamber of Commerce until August of last year. Good evening.
Good evening.
Well, look, there's a pause for 30 days. What is your reaction to the deal that's been struck, temporarily at least?
We don't have all of the details about the deal, but at least it's good news that 12 midnight tonight, we're not going to be seeing tariffs going to place on both sides of the border. We're going to need to have more information about what's involved here. Prime Minister Trudeau, about half an hour ago, tweeted that a deal had been reached. It was focused on fentanyl and on what could be done on the border. I see that the New York Times reports that Trump confirms in a Truth Social post that he will pause his threat to impose tariffs on Canada for 30 days, quote, to see whether or not a final economic deal can be structured.
Yes, I mean, there's a bit more detail coming out. Prime Minister Trudeau said, had a good call with President Trump. Canada implementing a $1.3 billion border plan, nearly 10,000 frontline personnel sent to protect the border. Clearly, there are costs involved here for Canada. And there's also the fact that it would appear that by just issuing this threat, Donald Trump has got, initially at least, what he wants. I mean, what does that say to you about how this relationship is going to look like during the Trump presidency?
We're not sure what it is that he wants and whether he got what he wants. So what I just mentioned to you was what President Trump was saying since then on Truth Social, where he's talking about a final economic deal with Canada. He talked earlier today, for example, about, for the first time last night, he put it on the table that he wanted greater potential for U.S. banks to be able to enter the Canadian market. This may or may not be a deal on fentanyl on the border. It may very well be that this is just the first installment of what he's looking for.
Well, whatever it is, sir, whatever it is, the message surely coming out of today is that Canada and Mexico as well, of course, but Canada will fold, will cave in at the first pressure of this kind from President Trump.
Yeah, I don't agree with that at all. What, you know, Canada, when Prime Minister Trudeau mentioned the fact that we made an offer of $1.3 billion to deal with border upgrades. This was made several weeks ago, and this is an integral part of the agreement that was reached today. Canada's position has always been that when it came to reinforcing the border or when it came to dealing with organized crime or with drugs, that we were anxious to work with the U.S. and would be glad to do that. Today's agreement, based on what Mr. Trudeau had to say, builds on that and extends it, talks about doing more in terms of a joint organized crime task force, for example. That's a good idea. That's not folding. It makes good sense for both countries.
Right. So if America portrays this as some sort of victory, you think that's hyperbole, do you?
Well, we will know that we know that Mr. Trump will portray it as a victory.
Just explain again why it isn't. So your argument is that Canada was going to do this anyway. But I suppose the question is why this needed to happen.
Well, the broader question is it all about the border and fentanyl, or is there more at play here? When Mr. Trump talks about a final economic deal, I don't think he's talking just about the border there.
What do you suspect then his real intentions are?
Well, he's talked about the balance of trade between Canada and the United States. He's talked about the entry of U.S. banks into Canada.
He's talked about Canada being the 51st state of the United States.
He talked today about Canada being the 51st state. The challenge for us in all of these discussions up until now is that you need to know when you're negotiating with someone what their bottom line is. What is it that they really need to be satisfied? And in Mr. Trump's case and the statements he's made, the goalposts constantly move. So what those of us in the private sector will be looking for is to get a better understanding of what is the bottom line here. What does the delay of 30 days mean? It's good news. There's no question about that. But what are the next steps?
Perrin Beattie, former Canadian Foreign Minister, former CEO of the Canadian Chamber of Commerce. Thanks very much indeed. And later on in the programme, we'll return to what's being called Donald Trump's trade war. We'll ask what method might lie behind the president's foreign policy moves. Now, the education secretary here, Bridget Phillipson, has said the government will step in more quickly to help struggling schools. That's based on the new Ofsted report cards that were revealed today. The new colour-coded report cards would have one or two word judgments across a range of categories, including quality of education, behaviour and leadership, giving, according to the government at least, a more nuanced view of the school's performance. Well, the old single-word judgments were scrapped last year after a coroner ruled that an Ofsted inspection had contributed to the death of primary school head teacher Ruth Perry. She took her own life in 2023 after Ofsted downgraded her school's rating to inadequate. In an interview with the BBC, the Education Secretary was asked about accusations that she was keeping the most dangerous parts of a system that contributed to Ruth Perry's death.
I know the family have been through a terrible ordeal, and what they have experienced has been a catalyst for change and reform across the system. This will make sure that there are a wider range of areas where we consider what a school is doing well or where there is need to improve. But alongside that, it's not just the report cards, it's the wider reform that is needed. There is more that we need to do, particularly around governance and transformation of Ofsted.
The head of Ofsted, Martin Oliver, said that parents didn't want the single word judgment, but they did want clarity about the school's performance. He added that the new report card, which is still subject to a consultation, would help to raise standards amongst pupils and reduce pressure on educational professionals. Well, Professor Julia Waters is Ruth Perry's sister. She's campaigned for changes to the Ofsted system. What does she make of that assessment?
I don't see the justification, sadly, for either of those claims. I fail to see how combining that with essentially a rehash of the old system, which is based on shame and punishment and these judgments, I fail to see how that can improve standards, and it essentially fails to address the key issue, which is considering the impact of the system on the well-being of teachers and school leaders.
But doesn't removing that overall single word judgment make a difference in terms of there not being that just one word that somebody might fixate on?
Well, now we have five words, colour-coded, to add to the insult. And as the Ofsted information explains, any individual one of those judgments could still have the kind of career-ending consequences, potentially, of the one overall effectiveness judgment, which we had before.
Would you accept, though, that the parents, who are also obviously part of all this, do want a degree of clarity and that there is a balance to be struck between the safeguarding aspects, the ways to improve standards for students, but also to give parents a degree of clarity about what school they are either sending their child to or what school their child is at?
Absolutely. We need clarity. These proposals seem to me to be trying to combine two irreconcilable things, greater detail, greater nuance, greater context with these headline judgments. Ofsted haven't addressed the key questions that needed to be addressed, the impact of their system on the well-being of head teachers and Ofsted's own accountability.
Bridget Phillipson, of course, says that this is all part of a broader reform of Ofsted. I mean, do you think Ofsted can be reformed in its current iteration, or, as some unions have suggested, does it need to go?
I stood up at the NEU conference last year and opposed NEU's argument that Ofsted ought to be abolished. I said that what was needed was radical reform. Well, this was Ofsted's chance to reform itself, and I think it's proven that it can't reform itself and shouldn't be allowed to reform itself. And frankly, if this consultation is, as Bridget Phillipson has assured me, a genuine consultation, I think now is the time for the teachers out there, everybody, parents, school children, everybody affected by education and by the inspection system, to teach Ofsted a lesson.
So it can be reformed, but it needs to come from the government.
I think it needs to be reformed, not to be allowed to reform itself.
Given the awful circumstances which have led you to be so involved in this particular issue, do you feel let down by the government, by what has happened up until today?
I do. It's been a 2-year battle the inquest found that an Ofsted inspection had contributed to my sister's death. Then there was a parliamentary inquiry which vindicated our findings about many of the flaws within the system, the undue impact on the well-being of head teachers and teachers. And now we have these proposals for a new system. And when the consultation is launched, there's no mention of Ruth, no mention of the Prevention of Future Deaths report or the inquest, no mention of the independent learning review that Ofsted themselves commissioned. Instead, they framed it as a response to their own Big Listen. It feels like having made progress with taken a massive step back here in this failure of Ofsted to acknowledge the context and the failings that have led them to be in the public eye in the way they are, to need to reform.
Clearly, you're doing this in memory of your sister to make sure that the circumstances of her death are known as widely as possible and to prevent others from meeting death in the same way. I mean, as things stand now, are head teachers in any more secure, safe position than they were when your sister took her own life?
They are, to the extent that they know they're not alone, that they feel more empowered to speak out and to seek help, that they realise that there is a problem with the school accountability system, that it's not their fault. But in terms of having confidence in Ofsted to listen to their complaints, to have confidence in Ofsted to prevent it happening again? No, I don't.
I detect there's real frustration, but a fair amount of anger on your part.
Yeah, anger, frustration. But the problem is when you use a word like anger, it can be used against you. Some of the things that I have said over the last couple of years have been sort of twisted into, oh, obviously we have a distressed family here. We have an angry family, as if that diminishes the legitimate concerns we have and undermines the things that we're saying about institutions that need to change.
Professor Julia Waters, the sister of Ruth Perry. Now, from standards in schools, we turn now to a rare but vulnerable piece of scientific memorabilia in a university. It is a blackboard covered with equations written by Albert Einstein and signed by the genius himself. And it's been hanging with little fuss or fanfare on a wall at the University of Nottingham. But with construction work putting Einstein's dusty jottings at risk, scientists at Nottingham want to rehouse the blackboard. I've been hearing more from Dr. Emma Chapman, a cosmologist at the university's physics department.
Just under 100 years ago, the University of Nottingham invited Albert Einstein to come and tell everybody in the physics department all about his new theories of general relativity, which are the idea of how space-time works, how the universe works. He was friends with one of the heads of department here. And so on the evening, he was due to give a lecture. He did turn up late, which is very Einstein. He ended up getting distracted by Isaac Newton's house in Lincolnshire on the way. But he did turn up and he spoke in German about all of these theories, all of these mathematical equations. And as he was doing so, we had one of the physicists actually translating from German to English. And also he was transcribing the mathematical equations on blackboard.
A blackboard which Einstein then signed.
Yes, that's correct. So it's one of very few blackboards in existence and the only signed one that we know of at all. There's one more in the UK at the University of Oxford. There were two, but somebody unfortunately cleaned one of them. So this is a very, very rare item and it's got a wonderful signature and a date right at the bottom of it. And you can see all of the text. You can identify the equations that describe a black hole. You can see his signature.
And no chance of it being cleaned because it is preserved, isn't it?
Thankfully, yes. We've had the common sense here at Nottingham to put it behind glass so that nobody can make that mistake. But it's definitely in need of some TLC. It's not at the kind of state-of-the-art conservation levels that we need it to be, that it deserves to be at.
So how concerned are you at the moment that the glass isn't good enough?
I mean, honestly, I'm quite concerned, and it's not just the glass, it's that it's fixed to a wall in a fairly crude manner of a very little used meeting room here at the physics department. And we're currently having lots of construction work done. And so every time one of the drills goes off, I'm having kittens thinking, oh my Lord, chalk particles could be floating off this thing. So I think, you know, anybody from a museum would just come in and sob if they actually saw the state that we have it in at the minute. We've tried really hard, but you know what? As physicists, this is not our expertise.
No. Well, maybe the construction bit could be, but what about what you're planning to do now? You've clearly identified the problem. What are you hoping the solution will be?
Well, we're hoping to conserve it, to recover any damage done, but also at the same time, bring it out so that the public and the students, most importantly, can actually see this piece of heritage, because at the minute, as I said, it's in a very little used corner of the physics department. You can honestly go through your entire degree at Nottingham, not know it's there at all. So the idea is to bring this piece of history out into the public domain, but we need money to do that. We even have the piece of chalk that he wrote on the blackboard with. I think it's just a case of we're so used to having it there. It's kind of like a shrug and a, oh, do you want to go see Einstein's blackboard on open days? And people go up there and they go, what? All generations are absolutely floored by this object. But the state of higher education as it is, we simply don't have the money to preserve a blackboard, however important it is.
Dr. Emma Chapman from the University of Nottingham. President Trump said today that he has no guarantees the ceasefire in Gaza will hold ahead of his meeting in Washington tomorrow with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. But the ceasefire is holding for now, and that's allowed medical evacuations from the Gaza Strip to resume. The World Health Organization estimates that there are between 12 and 14,000 critical patients who need to be evacuated for treatment. Among them is Habiba al-Askari, a child suffering from a rare blood condition that causes her limbs to develop gangrene. Our special correspondent Fergal Keane has been following her case, and he sent this report from the Al-Karama airbase on the Jordanian-Israeli border.
Well, at any moment now, Habiba will arrive here by ambulance and be transferred to the helicopter behind me. And from here, it's another journey. 30 minutes by air, approximately, to a man, where doctors will then try to establish a precise diagnosis so that she can get the treatment she so badly needs. Habiba al-Askari is suffering from a rare blood condition which has caused her to lose movement in three of her limbs. Two legs and an arm have gone black with a type of gangrene. Doctors treating her in Gaza's Nasser Hospital said she would die if she wasn't evacuated. Her mother, Rana, described Habiba's suffering.
If she asks me for a biscuit, I cannot give it to her. If I hand it over to her, she gives me a look. I can't describe to you the look that she gives me. I can only pray to God to heal Habiba and make me a miracle on earth in healing her.
Habiba is being treated by a team of doctors from the charity Medical Aid for Palestine. Dr. Riaz Wasaid from Manchester told our journalist about the seriousness of her condition.
We are really pushing to try and get her medevaced out of Gaza as soon as possible in order to save her life and to try and salvage whatever is possible out of her limbs.
Habiba's evacuation was postponed on several occasions. At one point, Israel approved Habiba's transfer, but refused to allow her mother travel with her. That decision was rescinded last night in what Israel called an extraordinary humanitarian gesture. Then there was confusion over whether her 12-year-old brother could travel.
It was a tiring effort, but it brought a result and I got permission. Now my son Sohaib is left. Oh God, please let me not endure the fire of being away from him.
That issue was quickly resolved and Habiba, her mother and brother are on their way here to Amman.
Fergal Keane reporting. Let's return to our main story now, the latest twists and turns in the saga of Donald Trump's proposed tariffs. as America's allies and adversaries try to assess the impact of the US president's early moves and to anticipate his next ones. They're also trying to work out the thinking behind them. During Mr. Trump's first term, decisions such as withdrawing from the Paris Climate Agreement led historians to use the term isolationism. But some of his second-term ambitions, such as taking over Greenland and the Panama Canal, don't seem to fit with that definition of the United States withdrawing from the wider world. Well, Jennifer Mittelstadt is a professor of history at Rutgers University. She thinks the Trump project more closely resembles a strain in American thinking called sovereigntism. And she's been telling me about its origins.
It emerges really in 1919 with the end of World War I. And it's a time when globalism, which has been at its all-time height, is coming to an end. There are new nationalist groups and new nations that are forming. And there's this idea, for the first time, that there will be some kind of international or supranational government. And that's the League of Nations.
And crucially, there were elected officials in America who were against it and who ensured that the plan to join the League of Nations after the First World War didn't happen.
That's exactly right. Probably the best known, at least in the United States, is Senator Henry Cabot Lodge. But there's a group known as the Irreconcilables who defeat the proposal. And what's interesting about that is that it really is pressure from grassroots groups that convinces them over the course of this debate, which goes on for several months, to in fact come out against it. People who I would think of as kind of conservative, we call them in the US constitutional nationalists, who are quite leery of any growth of the state or regulation of business. There are groups of very fundamentalist Christian evangelicals who are quite leery of the idea of a kind of secular world government. And then there are just patriotic organizations that think of themselves as nationalist champions, like the Daughters of the American Revolution.
So let's link this, as you have done, to President Trump and his foreign policy. What are the obvious links then in your mind between this and the kind of measures that President Trump is taking in his second term?
Well, one way to think about it is just to recognize that the 1919 moment, in some ways, and the groups who array themselves around it, continue. There's the opposition to entrance into World War II on the side of the Allies. There's a great long battle against the United Nations, which, of course, the U.S. not only joins, but in many ways really leads. What I think that Trump draws on is that I think that he sees the long strain of anti-internationalism as a useful form of politics for him to deploy. There are many people who support him who are, in fact, anti-internationalist and very much oriented around national sovereignty. They have whole agendas that are called the National Sovereignty Agenda. And they've long been in favor of pulling out of international agreements. And in Mr. Trump, they see a champion, I think.
It sounds like it's a repudiation of what is relatively recent American Republican history, which is George W. Bush's second inaugural address and what came out of that, which was spreading freedom around the world.
Indeed, I think you've put your finger right on it. I think there are some ways in which anti-internationalist sovereigntists view the era at the end of the Cold War as the worst period of internationalism. And the Bushes probably come in, that is both Presidents Bush, George H.W. and W., come in for some of the greatest criticism in the 1990s and early 2000s. They executed the New World Order in their mind. They sent U.S. troops to work under the blue helmets of the UN in any number of peacekeeping endeavors. They also implement the global trade Washington consensus all around the world, and they're really the architects of real global government.
So when we look at some of the things, and it's hard to keep track of them, that Donald Trump has done in his first couple of weeks back in office, the tariffs, the threats to retake the Panama Canal, calling Canada the 51st state of the United States, the pulling out of the World Health Organization. I mean, do they all fit into this model?
I don't think they all fit into the model, but I think some things do. I mean, it's quite clear that the Panama Canal draws on this long rejection of internationalists suggesting to the U.S. that it cannot hold a territory that it feels that it once held. I think the rattling of the EU is intended to undermine the EU's integrity, frankly, and to encourage right-wing movements there to withdraw from their international relations, really, with other EU countries. So there are a range of things that he is doing that I think are really consistent with this anti-internationalist sovereigntist politics right now.
And does it feel to you, with your historian's hat on, that we are entering a new era then, where this is the prevailing mood around the world?
You know, when I first started this project, I would have said no. But as I've seen things develop over time, I think I do see the emboldening of each other around the world. In other words, the more that President Trump invokes an anti-internationalist sovereigntist perspective, the more we can expect to see right-wing or right-led regimes that are also skeptical of sovereignty do the same.
History professor Jennifer Mittelstadt. Now, there was pure joy for Nottingham Forest fans at the weekend as their team beat Brighton 7-0 in the Premier League. Now, it was especially joyous for those fans watching the match in the Gedling Inn in Nottingham. That's because shortly before kick-off, landlady Becky Webster had offered them all a free pint for every goal scored by the Reds. Well, today she's nursing a bit of a financial hangover after that offer left her £1,500 out of pocket. She told me why she'd done it.
It was a new thing for us to be able to show Nottingham Forest on the TV. So we just thought we'd put it out there to get everyone in.
And what a match to choose.
Yes, we never imagined that it was going to be, obviously, 7-0. I thought maybe, you know, a couple of pints for each customer be a nice thing to give back. But when the fourth, fifth, sixth goal went in, it was, yeah.
So as you heard the cheers or watched it, I don't know if you were watching the game at that point, what were you thinking as number five, number six, number seven went in?
I was upstairs feeding my daughter when the first and the second goal went in, and I could hear the cheers downstairs, which was amazing. But by half time, I was kind of getting a bit panicky. And then I would say four or five, I thought, let's get the whistle blown now.
You'd have settled for four or five. So you've done a calculation, I guess, have you? You've worked out just how many pints or how much you gave away.
Yes, we added it up kind of at the end of the day, and we think it was about 300 pints. It's a mixture of emotions between, you know, being really happy that Forest won and obviously quite a lot of things to give away. But the publicity that we've had from it has just been absolutely amazing. So it has been well worth it.
Yeah, we're talking to you now, but you've had calls, I think, from all around the world, haven't you?
Yeah, from loads of places with different radio stations, different newspapers, and just people contacting us from all around the world, America, Australia, Poland, France, just to say hello and to say thank you and well done for supporting the team.
Well, yes, I'm sure Forest fans around the world, you'll sort of be a legendary pub now, won't you?
Yes, hopefully. I'm hoping that we'll gain a lot of followers from it and they'll come and watch the games with us.
Has the club been in touch at all?
Yes, I have actually spoken to someone from the club and we're having a meeting tomorrow.
Ah, right. So, you know, mascots or something like that.
Who knows? Yeah, I might be invited onto the pitch.
I think there's a reasonable chance. So, look, I suppose the obvious question is, would you do this again?
Yes, we've already been in talks about doing something. We're not sure whether it'd be as dramatic as a free pint for every goal, but definitely something, definitely another promotion and, you know, keep people interested in what we're doing.
But what was it like just on the day? You were getting a bit preoccupied with just how much money you'd given away, how many pints you'd given away. But what was it like in the pub?
Yeah, the atmosphere was absolutely incredible. Everyone was so happy. They were dancing, they were singing, and people stopped and celebrated after the game as well. And people came back from the ground and came and had pints with us. So it was like a party atmosphere.
Quite an expensive party.
Yes.
But hearing your voice, no, absolutely no regrets. This is the best thing you could have done, do you think?
Yeah, no regrets. No, I would back the team any day.
Becky Webster, landlady of the Gedling Inn in Nottingham, big Nottingham Forest fan. That is The World Tonight. This is James Kamara-Sami. I'll be back tomorrow at 10. But for now, from me and everyone on the programme, good night.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on. And take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.